we're going to go on, please, to case number 4, and that is case number 2001-2491, the United States of America versus Kevin C. Brown, and it's Mr. Kasson. Good morning.
Good morning to the court. May it please the court, my name is Luke Kasson. I defended the defendant down below in the Northern District of Indiana. We have several issues for consideration today, the most pressing of which involves the question of whether intentional discrimination by a government prosecutor is reversible error. Essentially, we already know the answer to that question. What we need to know is what this prosecutor did a violation of Batson versus Kentucky? A short synopsis of how things happened, three challenges to three separate witnesses. All three witnesses are black female
jurors.
I'm sorry, jurors. And all three of them were struck with peremptory challenges.
You know, it seems to me that one could make a fairly solid argument that two of the three jurors you're focusing on should have been excused for cause, given that Ms. Robinson's husband had been convicted of a firearms offense and Ms. Hart's mother had shot and killed her estranged husband. What reason do we have to think that the government was engaging in race or gender discrimination by striking those two jurors?
A couple of ways, Your Honor. Number one, this case before you is not about the use of strikes for cause. It's about the use of peremptory challenges and how that those bore on the race issues.
Those are pretty strong reasons for exercising peremptory challenges, even if they're not challenged for cause. I think you got a reasonable case here on the school teacher.
Certainly, with regard to Ms. Robinson and Ms. Hart, there was extensive discussions with Ms. Robinson and Ms. Hart.
Focus on the legal standard here for a moment.
Mm-hmm.
You invoke the Batson process. You say, I think this is a racially tainted use of a peremptory. The prosecutor then, in each case, states the reasons, and the reasons are the ones that Judge Rovner just summarized, and the district court concludes, at step 3, if you will, that these are race-neutral reasons. This is a finding of the district court to which we owe substantial deference, and I have a hard time saying, even if I were looking at it as an initial matter, that this is not a point. It seems to me the prosecutor says people who, you know, have a husband convicted of a firearms offense or people who have actually killed somebody are not people I want on the jury, no matter who they are.
Well, I guess we need to clear up the record or correct the record. The testimony of, or the discussions with Ms. Hart were that she was a witness to a murder. She was not a party to it.
But her mother was
party to it. She wouldn't be on the jury. She'd be in jail.
Right. Yeah.
Exactly. Well, there's the misconception.
What is the reason, once district court gets these facts in front of it, and what possible reason is there for thinking that the real reason for these peremptories was an impermissible racial reason, as opposed to the one that the prosecutors articulated?
Well, let's look at Ms. We can look at Ms. Hart in particular. She was...
You know what? I think you should move to Ms. Lane. I really do. Because time is short.
Okay. And that's really what it gets down to. The rule of law is fairly simple. I don't have to show that every black woman was inappropriately excused.
Right.
Only one, if excused for the wrong reasons, is sufficient for reversal. Now, Ms. Lane in particular said very little in voir dire. She is a school teacher. There are cases cited by the government that says, in summary, you can exclude or excuse because they're school teachers. But looking at the situation as a whole,
for any reason, it's not an impermissible reason.
It is not. That's why you look at all of these circumstances, all of the circumstances that eventually leads to the choosing of a jury.
But, you know, now, if you had evidence that the government was allowing white school teachers to sit on the jury and was only exercising peremptories against African-American school teachers, then we'd have something to go on. But I didn't see anything like that in this record. Is there anything there?
There isn't in this record, and here's the problem. There were school teachers on the veneer, but that's not the basis of the government's exclusion. It's because she's a school teacher aide. Apparently, that there's an idea in the prosecutor's head that a school teacher's aide is somehow defense-oriented.
But if that's not a racial idea, if that's what it is, then it seems to me you've given your case away.
Well, that's simply the pretext of it. Simply giving the answer, looking at a sheet, a jury sheet, I can come up with any number of reasons. What prosecutor is going to say, yeah, I don't like black women?
But didn't the government explain that it excused her not only on the grounds of her profession, but of her age?
That's correct, because she was the youngest on that particular panel, not because she was the youngest in the veneer, or that ultimately were chosen as jurors. Now, we have to take, as trial counsel, we have to take them as we come. We have a certain number on the panel at the time, and she may have been the youngest. But, of course, she could have been 42 and been the youngest.
But she wasn't 42.
But she wasn't 42. She was 27, but there were younger jurors on that veneer. And counsel at trial does not deny that that's the case. He has the jury sheets, and those are simply looking at all of the circumstances here. The only ones that were struck with a pattern were black women.
Do you want to go on to your Brady issue and the firearm?
Yes, Your Honor.
I'm wondering how would information about the ownership of the firearm have helped Mr. Brown, given that the question for the jury was whether and was not who owned the gun, but whether or not Mr. Brown possessed the gun.
Ultimately, Your Honor, the question is whether Kelly Moore had a opportunity to have possessed that gun. Ultimately, the question for the jury was, as you indicated, who had the gun in the possession at the time of the crime? But the answer to the possession and whether the trace report would indicate possession in someone else, particularly Kelly Moore, would be damning evidence to the government's case.
But the district court, in his opinion that is attached to your brief, specifically says that when he looked at the report in camera, he says Brown's argument assumes that Moore was listed on the trace report. The court has confirmed that is not the case. So how does this wind up being Brady evidence?
In the end, it is not a Brady issue, given what the district court has ruled. This is a discovery issue. Certainly, and the way it came about was simply this. At sentencing, we had no idea that the evidence existed. At sentencing, the assistant U.S. attorney asked the court to impose an upward departure based on the gun being stolen, which of course prompted me to ask for the gun trace report. Once that gun trace report was requested, the upward departure was abandoned. And of course, then I made formal requests for that gun trace report, having the hunch that, of course, that would lead to information pointing directly to Kelly Moore. I would like to reserve some of my time. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Okay. Mr. Bella.
Good morning, Your Honor. I'm Daniel Bell, arguing the case on behalf of the government. I was not the attorney at the trial court level. I am, however, the attorney who prepared the government's brief in this case. There are three issues that are raised. As to the first two of the issues, the Batson issue and the voice stress test issue, I'd like to stand on the government's brief.
Except I'd like to ask you why teachers are perceived to be more defense-oriented than other professionals.
I don't know why that is, Your Honor. It may have to do with individual prosecutors' experience with previous jury panels. If they had a jury panel where there was a teacher who was a foreperson and the panel, and if they had several experiences like that where the jury ruled against them, that may have formulated a prosecutor's view of teachers as jurors. It's a subjective thing, and I think it may vary from one trial attorney to the next. Other attorneys, be they prosecutors or defense counsel, may have other groups that they would not want on the jury, members of the clergy, for example. In this case, this particular trial attorney had a practice of excluding teachers from his jury panels, and we don't have other cases in front of us, but I would think that we would find that practice consistent from case to case with this particular attorney. And the courts have said that there's nothing wrong with that. For whatever reason, the attorney in this case formed an opinion that teachers, in his opinion, were not persons that he wanted on his jury or were comfortable with having on his jury. And evidently, other attorneys in other parts of the country have also formed that same opinion because this matter has been addressed by other courts as well. And as I say, I think from one trial attorney to the next, jury selection can largely be a subjective thing, and we all have our own reasons for choosing jurors the way we do. In this case, this was the reason, or one of the two reasons given by this this attorney, and the courts have said that that's permissible. With regard to the voice stress test, I think the court not only ruled properly, but I think, and the brief points out, I think that the defense got all the mileage out of that issue that they were going to get anyway. So I don't think that is an issue that needs to be addressed more so than the government has in its brief. With regard to the TRACE report, I think one thing to note, maybe the first thing to note, is the strength of the evidence in this case. The prosecutor, the trial attorney, our government's attorney, went to great length to show step-by-step the process of what happened on the street outside of Joylynn Moore's apartment. The police cars followed each other one after another, three police cars in a row. And each police car arrived on the scene in time to observe the previous police car, which had been there, and leaving the scene. The first police car arrived on the scene, and Kelly and the defendant, Kevin Brown, is standing by his car, and there's one person standing by the Moore's vehicle. And the police officer shines his light on the two vehicles, and the defendant starts to run when the light shone on him.
Was the one person by the Moore vehicle Kelly? Joylynn had left by this time?
The first police officer, I'm not sure that he identifies that person, but I think the rest of the evidence indicates that was Kelly Moore. Joylynn Moore testified that she had gone back into the apartment, and by the time she came out, the police car was already there. And I think the testimony of other police officers identified Kelly Moore as the person by that car.
Even if the TRACE report doesn't identify Kelly Moore as an owner of the firearm, isn't it possible that the report might have led to other information that might have been helpful for the defense? I mean, for instance, what if it disclosed that Mr. Moore had a brother-in-law or an extra neighbor or a cousin who owned the rifle?
I think without knowing more, that would be speculation on our part. And I want to point out that the way the issue was developed in the trial court is revealed by the portion of the judge's ruling, which was read previously today by this court, and that is that the defendant has argued that that TRACE report will show that Kelly Moore was on the chain of title of that firearm, and the TRACE report does not show that. That's the way that the issue was developed below. That's the way the judge clearly took the issue and the way the judge ruled. that's the way the government attorney took the issue. And it isn't until late in the game, perhaps the day of sentencing, and if not then, here on appeal, that the defendant starts to argue that maybe there might have been something else that he could have garnered from that trace report. But I think it's unfair to the district court and to this court not to have that issue developed earlier so that it could have been dealt with. But the way the issue was developed, at least the way the court and the government attorney understood it, was that Kelly Moore, or that the defendant, was alleging that Kelly Moore's name somehow would show up in the chain of title. And
what's the policy of your U.S. Attorney's Office with respect to discovery in criminal cases? Do you stick to the Brady line and Jenks, or do you have open file, or what do you do?
Well, I think it probably varies from case to case. At a minimum, of course, Brady discovery must be made, Rule 16 discovery must be made. And I think it depends on the prosecutor and on the case as to what, in addition to that, is revealed. I think if there is a sense that it's a relatively simple case that can be resolved quickly, if only everyone sees all the report, then perhaps it helps speed up the process to simply open the file to everyone. But there's no set policy, if you will, that all files are open file or all files are limited only to Brady and Jenks. Defendant counsel on appeal here acknowledges that he's not standing on this as a Brady violation now. He's standing on this as a discovery violation. And with regards to this as a discovery matter, the standard is an abuse of discretion standard. The appellant must show that an abuse of discretion by the court in its discovery ruling, and the appellant also must show prejudice. And I don't think that the defendant can show either. I don't think he can show prejudice because even with the judge ruled, trial court judge ruled about that trace report, I don't think the defendant can show that the outcome of this trial would have been any different, especially in light of the strength of the evidence that we have. There is no way that Kelly Moore or anyone else could have approached the defendant's car carrying an assault rifle and planted it in that car under this set of facts, because you have the police arriving, the first police officer, while the defendant is still standing right next to his car. And every police officer after that arrives in time to see the previous police officer leaving. There's no way that anyone could have approached that car to have planted that rifle. And that's why I think the real strength of this is the facts of this case. I think the defendant cannot show prejudice under these facts. And also the judge did not abuse his discretion in making the rulings that he did. Unless there are any further questions. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Bella. Mr. Kasten, how much time? 2 minutes.
2 minutes. Just as a matter of course, on a gun case in the Northern District of Indiana, those trace reports are turned over routinely. They are routinely turned over because most of those cases, or all of those cases, are ICC cases, and they, because they have to show nexus, the interstate nexus, they usually turn those over. In this case, that wasn't the case. The only case that I've ever dealt with in the Northern District of Indiana where it was not turned over, and it was not turned over because I was informed that it wasn't available, and that's what we took to trial with that knowledge. With regard to the fact, the testimony in the transcripts is pretty clear. Whether you take the government's view of it or you take our view of it and just look at how close they were when Joy Lynn left the scene, how much opportunity he had to get across approximately a 15-foot street and get to the car, it's equivocal at best. And there certainly is plenty of information to land either way, but there's no question that there's prejudice by not turning over that trace report. It changed the whole nature of the case. I see that I'm out of time.
You have a minute.
Oh, I'm sorry. As for the teachers, it struck me as I heard Mr. Bella discussing it, is the government can have it both ways in a single trial with two different jurors. prosecutor could give an example or a reason that I don't want this person on because I don't like teachers. And that person could be excluded. At the same time, he can say, I want somebody because they are teachers, effectively not excluding. So you can, they can essentially have it both ways by simply looking at the jury form and saying, who is it that we want and who is it that we don't want, based not on the occupation or some other factor in the jury report or the jury questionnaire, but based on the race. And we'd never be able to determine what that was, because they're not going to say, I'm discriminating. They're going to say it's because she's a teacher or because he's a steel worker. That's why we can still look at what happened to Mrs. Robinson and Mrs. Hart as evidence. And parenthetically, the dismissal of Detective Cooper Stanley, who was also a black female and investigated the case and was involved in the voice stress test, I think that also bears weight on the government's discriminatory act in this case.
Mr. Kasson, you were appointed, were you not?
I was, Your Honor.
Well, you have the thanks of the court for
Thank
your
you.
Vigorous defense of your client.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. And thanks to you as well, Mr. Pella. And the case will be taken under advisement.